Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Coming to you semi-live from a bunker somewhere in Guelph, Ontario. This is Back in the USSR, and I'm Siegfried. It's been a while, my friends. There's been a lot of complications this year which prevented me from doing the show. But fortunately, enough of them have been sorted out to permit me to bring this episode to you now on CFRU 93.3 FM. And remember, this is semi-live. You know, stress that point. Now, well, let's start with the elephant in the room. Yes, this is a plague year. The COVID pandemic is lurking in the back of everyone's mind. And it's scary. And when people are scared, this is really going to be the theme of the whole show here, and something I wanted to talk about for a long time. When people are scared, they often make decisions they later regret. They lay blame without evidence. They close ranks against those they perceive as the other. They rally to the side of abusers and exploiters. And that's the real tragedy of this pandemic, you know, above and beyond the more than 1 million dead worldwide, most of whom would still be with us today had the factors I just mentioned not been driving the policies of certain powerful nation states, combined with the overriding concern for the profit motive and the fanatical desire to open up and return to business as usual, even as virus deaths continue to surge. You know, in the world today, we're seeing which countries truly place the needs of people over profit and which countries do not. You know, by comparing Cuba to the United States or Vietnam to Brazil or China to India, you know, we see the real difference and distinction between socialism and capitalism in really stark terms. And the same is true in Canada, where we've lost thousands of people. You know, the private nursing home industry has been exposed for putting seniors into hellholes for the sake of wringing money out of them. And yet the government is all about opening up and business as usual. And we wonder why virus cases have spiked since the schools reopened without proper planning and as bars and restaurants reopen. You know, it's no surprise that the medical system in Ontario, you know, after years of cutbacks and neglect, is being strained to the breaking point. And medical workers who have been in harm's way from day one are burning out in record numbers. Canada has lost considerably more people to this virus than China has, despite having a far smaller population. I mean, we're close to 10,000 deaths right now in Canada, whereas China has lost less than 5,000. I mean, think about that for a moment. We're talking like a country of 36 million people compared to a country of 1.5 billion people. And yet the country with 36 million people has lost more people, almost double the number of deaths to COVID. It's pretty sobering. But this is the general pattern in capitalist societies when it comes to dealing with COVID. You know, and we've seen this, you know, at first they deny the problem. They don't take precautions until it's too late. They impose lockdowns without ensuring adequate testing, medical care, or food delivery. And then proceed to reopen everything for the sake of business interests while the virus is still spreading. The fact that Donald Trump and the U.S. government are still trying to blame China for the more than 220,000 COVID deaths in America, which is growing by almost like 1,000 every day. You know, they're trying to blame China when they had almost 3 months advanced warning about the virus and did absolutely nothing. It's just the height of hypocrisy. And working people are the ones who pay the price for this. You know, and this is the case in the US, this is the case in the UK, this is the case in, like, this was the case in Italy and the countries of Western Europe. This, you know, is the case in places like India and Brazil, and it's a disaster every time. Now, socialist states, by contrast, and countries which learned from socialist states, they all did things differently. They responded quickly. They took advanced warnings seriously. They tested everyone for the virus. They imposed quarantines while making sure human needs were met. And only reopened when the virus had been successfully contained and human-to-human transmission halted. And then, of course, they were prepared to go through the same process again if the virus reemerged. Even if you want to say that the Chinese government didn't act fast enough when the initial cases took place, you know, in December 2019. By December 10th of this year, they had warned the World Health Organization and begun taking the serious precautionary measures that led up to the complete lockdown of Wuhan and other cities, along with nationwide testing. And the series of measures which basically halted the virus in its tracks and only resulted in, like, you know, less than 5,000 Chinese people dying. Which is truly amazing, seeing like that is where the epicenter of the virus was. you know. And this is why the death toll in places like Vietnam, Cuba, the state of Kerala in India, and China, once again, where the original outbreak took place, this is why the death toll there is so much lower, and why those societies are mostly back to normal now. Whereas Canada, America, and the so-called advanced countries of the first world are headed into a second wave, even though the first wave never really ended. And the death toll is just keeps on mounting. I mean, 600 million people traveled throughout China during the so-called Golden Week holiday at the beginning of October, without any renewed outbreak of the virus. And even countries in Africa, where medical infrastructure is very minimal, they've been far more effective at dealing with the pandemic because they, you know, unlike many more advanced countries, those African countries took warnings about infectious disease seriously. They took it seriously and they took precautions. You know, and they understood and they took the advice of the World Health Organization in terms of what you should do to prepare for the pandemic, which is coming. You know, they took those precautions and they're, you know, they're doing quite well right now. And I specifically want to mention Cuba's international medical contributions since the pandemic began, because they've been nothing short of spectacular. You know, the small island under constant siege by the American superpower. And yet its Cuban doctors are putting their bodies on the line on almost every continent. You know, from Italy to Venezuela to Azerbaijan to Sierra Leone. You know, Cuban doctors have been everywhere helping contain the pandemic, helping people like fight against its spread. And Cuba is now in the advanced stages of developing its own COVID vaccine. Once again, this tiny little island that punches well above its weight. And really is an example about, like, you know, internationalism, international solidarity, you know, supporting other countries in the midst of this pandemic. It's really inspiring. But I want to return to the theme of scared people who are quick to assign blame and quick to allow themselves to be manipulated for the sake of security. Of course, we've seen all this before. We, you know, we've been through the, you know, the war on terror and the attacks on 9/11 and all this sort of thing. We saw the kind of things that happened back then, you know, and how people allowed themselves to be manipulated for the sake of security, you know. And this, of course, is not something, you know, it's not a phenomenon that's limited to Trump supporters or the far right. I mean, if huge percentages of people in countries as diverse as Canada, Sweden, and South Korea can have an overwhelmingly negative view of China in the wake of the pandemic, you know, higher percentages than Americans, by the way. You know, we're talking like in the 80s and even 90% range in some cases. You know, there's something else going on. Donald Trump's Sinophobia, his bigotry, his insistence on referring to COVID as the Chinese virus, it's all part of something larger. I mean, China has become everybody's punching bag in recent months. Pundits and politicians have proclaimed a new Cold War against China. And regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, the media will give you some reason to hate an entire country of 1.5 billion people, as well as a reason to stand, at least tacitly, on the side of America in what is being billed as the global conflict that will shape the 21st century. You know, the conflict, the global conflict. You know, whether it's civil liberties you care about, whether it's human rights, technological competition, geopolitical concerns, espionage, pollution, the accusation that China isn't truly Marxist. You know, take your pick. It's truly remarkable to me just how many people on the political left have sided with the American Empire, and by extension with Trump, without apparently realizing they've even taken sides. Because regardless of how much they hate or disagree with the US or what it does, for these progressives, the U.S. and the global West in general, it's still their team. Their team. Whereas China is the other. And this is what factionalism is all about. If a crime is committed by your team, you know, if something horrible is done by your team, the response basically is to redeem your team. Which is what most Western leftists seek to do. Whether that's by electing Bernie Sanders, supporting AOC, voting Green. You know, they don't want to overthrow the United States or Canada. They want to really overthrow the system. They want to clean it up. They want to make it live up to its promise or some such thing. So when the US invades and devastates Iraq, destroys Libya, bombs and divides Syria, imposes deadly sanctions on Venezuela and Iran, terrorizes and murders black people in the streets, and so on. These leftists, who consider America to be their team, these leftists will criticize American political policy, but they will not condemn America as something bad. They will not say America is bad or America is evil. And this is because they believe in America. They believe that America, their team, can be saved. And they're not willing to give up hope. And the end result is they keep giving more and more chances to their team in the hope that it will eventually do the right thing. Does that sound familiar at all? Endless second chances. Endless second chances. Now, this is not the way the Western left treats the other. China is not redeemable in their eyes, in the eyes of Western progressives. In their eyes, if China commits a crime, or is alleged to have committed a crime, they see it as confirmation of an inherent evil. That China is a bad place, with a bad government, it's a bad society. It is fundamentally messed up. It's not an aberration that can be corrected or fixed by electing the right person into office. Which is basically what they tell themselves about America. China is not their team, so it gets no second chances, even though its real or alleged crimes pale in comparison to the things that America, the global hegemon, the empire, has done in recent memory. I just gave you a whole list like in the last, just a few minutes ago there. Nor does it require nearly as much evidence for them to condemn the other as compared to their team. I mean, many people are willing to take it on faith that there are millions of Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps in northwest China. You know, they don't need to see really hard evidence for that. Whereas they are only willing to acknowledge U.S. war crimes in Iraq after Chelsea Manning leaked actual video evidence of American helicopters machine gunning civilians in the middle of Baghdad. And even after that, even then, they continue to consider the U.S. as a redeemable society. And the war crime to be an aberration. This is what factionalism does. Factionalism, that way of thinking. That's what it does. And this is a common denominator in many leftists in this part of the world. Particularly white leftists. And it's more than a little disturbing just how easily they can fall into factionalism. Even if they don't like the US government and what it does, they won't challenge. They won't fundamentally challenge its hostile policies in East Asia and call for peace with China, because that would mean offering potential support to the other. And they don't want to do that. And the US government and its allies in the media are perfectly aware of this. You know, they're not necessarily counting on the active support of these people. You know, it's like, you know, progressives, like for a confrontation with China, for a war with China. Their goal is to make any form of solidarity with China and its people morally indefensible. Something not even diehard radicals would risk doing. You know, their goal is to demonize China so much that no matter what American policy is, no one will offer solidarity with China. And by the looks of things and the poll data and all that kind of stuff, they're well on their way to doing that. You know, because China's name is basically mud to so many people right now. You know? And as people, in many cases, seek to assign blame, you know, for this whole pandemic. And, of course, Western politicians, they, you know, in many cases, blame China. That's what they do. You know, to kind of, like, turn people's attention away from the horrible handling, their horrible handling of the pandemic themselves, you know, the which resulted in, like, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths. They want to shift the blame over to China, to the other. You know, and it also helps that while people are being stirred up by the corporate media about what may or may not be going on in Hong Kong or Xinjiang, they're not focused on US-backed neo-Nazis in Ukraine and what they're doing. They're not focused on US-backed death squads murdering people, murdering indigenous people in Colombia on a daily basis. You know, we're talking entire massacres here, which don't make it into the mainstream press. The devastating US-backed war on the people of Yemen, which has basically completely fallen out of the headlines, but it's still going on. Or the US-backed Indian government's blatant campaign of Islamophobic violence and settler colonialism in Kashmir. You know, which has been under lockdown for a full year, no internet access, nothing. And just constant, like, you know, killings and, like, brutal attacks. You know, open violence against Muslims in India. But, you know, the media says nothing. You know, these stories are generally aren't even touched on in the media. And, you know, and yet there are things that Western activists could actually make a difference about if they mobilize people in sufficient numbers. You know, they could actually pressure their governments on this, right? They could pressure their government to, like, you know, back off on Yemen, you know, withdraw support for the genocidal government of Colombia, you know, withdraw support from neo-Nazis in Ukraine, you know, withdraw support from the Indian government. They could do these things, right? Western activists could make a difference on these things if they actually mobilized around these things, but they're not mobilizing around these things, you know. I mean, Western activists have failed to even mobilize people against the massive outbreak of Sinophobia and violence against Asian Americans and Asian Canadians that has emerged since the pandemic began. Approximately one third of Chinese Canadians have reported being physically attacked since the pandemic began. We're not even talking verbal abuse here. We're talking physical assault. One third of Chinese Canadians have reported this. Let that sink in. This is how epidemic this is. This kind of hate, this kind of hostility, this racism. And I'm just going to say this. If this was the 1960s and the Black Panthers were still a thing and Fred Hampton's Rainbow Coalition was still a thing, there would be no question that the Black Lives Matter protests and the struggle against Sinophobic violence would be united. You know, these two struggles would be united, and people from various oppressed communities would come together against the racist capitalist state in America. But as impressive and inspiring as the BLM campaign has been this year, and it's been amazing, you know, in terms of the mobilization and the defiance and the uprisings that have taken place across America and beyond, and the inspiration that's given to, you know, all kinds of, like, activism around the world. You know, I haven't seen much of that solidarity across the color line. You know, between, say, Black people and Asian Americans. You know, the kind of internationalism in one country that made the Rainbow Coalition so powerful and threatening to the status quo. Threatening to a status quo that wants to keep people divided. You know, and doesn't want, like, Asian Americans, Black people, you know, Hispanic people, Indigenous people from working together. They certainly don't want white people working with them either. You know, they want to keep people divided. That's the way they keep people in line. And internationalism, brothers and sisters, internationalism is the only thing that can defeat imperialism, that can roll back empire. International solidarity is the only thing that can give working class and oppressed people a fighting chance against a global capitalist system. It's a global system. The only way you fight against that is by unifying people across borders, across color lines, you know, getting people to join hands, overcome their fear, overcome any sort of xenophobia they might have. And right now, in the midst of a pandemic, isolation and rampant fear, the global capitalist system is what is dividing and conquering our minds. That's what it's doing right now. And we just can't let this happen. It's hard. I know people are scared, but we have to stand together. And back in the USSR is back, and it's going to, that's the message it's going to further as we go forward. So basically, as Fred Hampton used to say, peace if you're willing to fight for it, and just solidarity forever, okay? Cheers, brothers and sisters. Let's just keep advancing.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights throws me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body, their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution that chokes me, movies that joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me, Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Willie Dunn, Canadian Mi'kmaq singer, in fact, appropriately enough, who did that song in the 1970s, I Pity the Country, I Pity the State, the mind of the man thrives on hate. I think that's pretty appropriate given what's happening in Nova Scotia right now, so-called Nova Scotia, where, of course, you know, Mi'kmaq fishermen are being attacked, you know, their catches being, like, destroyed, you know, their equipment's being destroyed, you know, arson attacks on them, you know, physical assaults on them by commercial fishermen, you know, by the monopolists, by basically these guys who are pretty much pawns of the capitalists out there. And of course, they're also settlers and, you know, are attacking the indigenous people, you know, of course, expressing colonialism through through violence, which is basically always what colonialism's been about from the beginning. And so I want to express my solidarity with those Mi'kmaq fishermen who are standing for their rights right now. I also want to express solidarity with the people who are still fighting against the pipelines at West. And Wet'suwet'en is still absolutely resisting. And there's still, like, you know, aggressions being perpetrated against them all the time. And they're still standing strong, even though a lot of people aren't following that anymore. You know, given how COVID has just come in and just dominated everything in the headlines and what have you. So there isn't quite as much attention, like, which is, you know, understandable, you know, compared to, like, say, where it was earlier this year, where, you know, there's mass mobilization, just inspiring mobilization all around the country, around Wet'suwet'en, fighting back against the pipelines, fighting, you know, taking a stand against colonialism, you know, settler colonialism itself, and recognizing what a force that is in this country and why it needs to be fought against, and its connections with capitalism, you know, intimate connections with capitalist exploitation. You know, that was all recognized by the movements which emerged earlier this year. And those movements haven't really gone away. I mean, they might have become more low-key, but they're still there. You know, they're still fighting. And, of course, the indigenous people on the ground are absolutely still fighting for their own unceded land, you know, in BC and, frankly, all around the country. That's still going on, and we should understand that, and we should still show solidarity and still support them in those struggles. Stand with them as much as we can. You know, Caledonia, you know, here in Ontario, you know, the 1492, like, land defenders, you know what I mean? This is still going on here, you know, and they're facing arrest. They're facing jail time. You know, it's Six Nations, right? For defending, once again, their own territory, these Haudenosaunee people, you know, defending their own territory, their own land against developers who want to move in and take it. You know, so they're taking a stand against colonialism. They're also taking a stand against capitalism. They understand these two things are linked. And they also need support. So there's a lot going on right now. You know, I focus on Sinophobia and the racism going on with that, and this whole, like, new Cold War and all the messed up stuff around that and the conspiracy theories and all this. I was trying to basically get at that. There's just so much to talk about. Once again, I haven't been on air for, like, months. So it's hard to know where to start. So I did the best I could this week. And I'll be back again next week. I'm going to, you know, come in with another show. I mean, there's obviously all any of those things I just talked about, you know, whether it's, you know, Mi'kmaq fishermen or, like, you know, Wet'suwet'en or the land defenders of Six Nations. Like, all these things would merit their own show, basically. And I'm going to try to cover those things in the coming weeks. But, you know, we started out with the Sinophobia, with the big picture of worldwide picture, you could say, is what I wanted to start out with tonight. And so that's what I got into. It's been hard, you know, like, it's really been hard over the last several months, you know, like, not doing this show, wondering when the hell we could start up again. You know, it's once again, a lot of factors involved here. And everybody needs to be, once again, be safe at this time. And, you know, it's not something we want to rush. You know, and, like, what we talked about before, like, you know, with the capitalist state, like, rushing to reopen everything. And regardless of whether the virus has been, you know, decisively dealt with or not, you know, for the sake of business interests, for the sake of profit, you know, putting profit over human health and human well-being, you know. So obviously that's not what we want to do. So, like, I understand, like, why, you know, CFRU is still, like, kind of, you know, like, definitely taking this position. And it's a good thing they are. You know, like, you know, basically, you know, taking a step back and making sure everybody's safe and making sure the, you know, everything's in good shape before the station reopens. And, like, once again, we don't know when that's going to happen, but it'll happen at some point. And until then, you know, I'm going to make the most of what I got. Going to keep putting shows out, going to keep producing shows, and we're going to keep this going. So I mean, there we go. And so I'm going to leave things off for the next half hour. I'm going to play another broadcast by another talk by Michael Parenti, you know, one of the scholars, progressive scholars I find really inspiring. And we're going to get into that right now. And I'm going to be back here next week with another show. So solidarity, comrades, brothers and sisters. And I'll see you then.
Now then you got about 5 centuries of imperialism coming along. And imperialism was when the powers of Western Europe began to expropriate the land, labor, and wealth of Eastern Europe. That was the first area of expansion and exploitation that they went into. And the second was the New World. And then having developed all the superior firepower and mobility and transportation, they went then into Africa and Asia and further into Latin America. And with this imperialism, which is a history that really, to read the history of modern imperialism as it's still going on today, to read that history is really to read a history of a succession of the most horrendous, horrible atrocities that one can imagine. Now, when the ruling classes of these imperialist nations plundered and exploited the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of other people, when they enslaved their labor, when they burned their villages, when they destroyed their industries and their crafts and their mines and their herds and their crops, when they raped them and murdered them and mutilated them, when they did all that sort of thing, and they worked them to death in the latifundios and the plantations and in the mines, then theories had to come along to justify what you were doing. And the theories about these lesser races proliferated. These lesser races were animals. They were cruel savages. They were incapable of self-governance. They were like pathetic, helpless children. They'd been around living in peace for, 5,000 years before you came along, but suddenly now they wouldn't be able to get along without us. They were devoid of the normal sensibilities that one might expect from a person in civilized societies. Again, not an anachronistic attitude. In my own lifetime, in the lifetime of most of you, the adult lifetime of most of you, General Westmoreland, you remember him? Vietnam, your average Asian. The Asian doesn't place the same importance on life we Americans do. That's your average Asian. And with the massive bombings and saturation bombings, a war of horror and attrition and mass slaughter, he was pointing out that indeed one of those two protagonists did not place the same value on life as the other, but he had it mixed up, that's all. And with imperialism, there came in the 19th century the class-based, racist, patriarchal theories about human nature, known as science. Science came along and rushed in there with measurements of skulls and brain sizes. Whites were superior to blacks, males were superior to women, men of substance were superior to men of poverty. Race, gender, and class again. 19th century science gave us a great scientist, by the way, who took human beings out of the medieval metaphysical scheme of things and made them part of the natural order of things. And in a sense, it was a very revolutionary and very progressive thing that he did, a very great contribution, Charles Darwin. But a closer reading of some of the other things Darwin said in his Descent of Man, for instance, definitely shows him to be a product of 19th century science, which in turn is a product of 19th century imperialism and capitalism and upper class white male Europeans. Darwin, quote, "Man is more courageous, pugnacious, and energetic than woman, and has a more inventive genius." This is the best scientific mind of the 19th century in England, British Royal Society. "Men are superior in every activity requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination." Except imagination about women, I guess. Huh? "Men vastly excel in the sciences, philosophy, history, the arts, poetry, painting, and sculpture." Ready? Sisters, are you ready? Women excel in tenderness, unselfishness, intuition, imitation, and other qualities that are characteristic of the lesser races. Darwin argued, in effect, that women are less evolved biologically, evolutionarily. For Darwin, culture doesn't explain anything. By the way, it's true of most of these people. Cultural differences are the thing that needs to be explained. And these differences are explained as being grounded in biological development in human natures in the process of natural selection. In The Descent of Man, or natural selection, or both, combination of both, biological, innate biological structures and natural selection and development of those biological developments in natural selection. let's turn to what Darwin had to say about races. Now, this is, we're talking right 1880. This is when England is building an empire upon which the sun never sets. At the time Darwin is saying this, the Brits are killing a variety of people from Ceylon to India to Malaysia to God knows where's Africa, or working them to death. Darwin thought that the sense of smell was more highly developed in darker races, as in animals, than in white civilized peoples. The same, by the way, with other physiological characteristics. The rudimentary ear lobule, the larger wisdom teeth, the more pronounced conical form of the canine teeth, and certain bone structures, all supposedly common to the darker races, and all therefore more proximate to animal physiology, testify to their less advanced evolutionary development. By the way, none of that's true. In case you want to go checking teeth. Here's Darwin talking. Given, quote, the hideous ornaments and the equally hideous music admired by most savages, unquote, Darwin concluded that their aesthetic faculty was less developed than that of birds. I mean, what impresses you is the total oblivion, the total ignorance of the brutalities of imperialism, the total ignorance of the adverse effects on the health and survival of native peoples that imperialism had when they came into exposure to European diseases, the deracination, the mistreatment, the deaths. Darwin looks at this, he discusses some particular tribe that dies out. I think it was a tribe in the American Southwest. Says they died out. He concluded that the extinction of these tribes when they came in contact with whites was evidence of their lesser biological capacity, their immunity systems, their capacities, and such. Nothing having to do with starvation, nothing having to do with injecting smallpox into blankets and then selling them to the Indians, nothing having to do with the Gatling gun and the Maxim gun and mass murder. They die out because they're lesser. Savages snarled more often and had less control of their fear reactions and sphincter muscles than did Europeans, Darwin said. Now, how did he suppose he found that out? And what did he do to study that one? I don't know. It's not the kind of research I'd want to do. Thus, they were more like monkeys and dogs in that respect. That's from The Descent of Man. Civilized males were less emotive than savages and less inclined to weep. Now, even among civilized males, there were ethnic and evolutionary differences, by the way. Englishmen rarely cried or shrugged their shoulders energetically, while Frenchmen and Italians were given to such less advanced displays. Why the absence of shrugging of shoulders is seen as an evolutionary gain is not clear to me. I don't understand. You see, but you're getting this very interesting convolution. You're getting the trait of what is assumed to be the more evolved person as evidence of that evolution. So on the one hand, right, that Englishman manifests these traits. Therefore, these traits must be the more evolved traits. He has these more evolved traits, therefore he is more evolved. And the thing just kind of self-fulfills itself. Darwin, by the way, was rather ignorant of the so-called lesser peoples. I mean, if you ever want to, he mentioned the Italians, if you ever wanted to see a people, southern Italian peasants, who I'm sure he would feel very uncomfortable being in the same room with, if you ever want to see a people, having come from that stock myself, all my grandparents, both sides, if you want to see a people who had a rigorous idea of social strictures and interpersonal diplomacy and what was proper and what was hospitality and what you said and what you didn't say and how you presented this and didn't present that, or if you go to any savage society, so-called savage, or primitive peoples, native peoples, indigenous peoples, anywhere, whether it be American Indians or Melanesians, again, the same thing. Elaborate codes, certainly as elaborate, as advanced, as subtle, as nuanced as anything you could find in upper-class English society. Maybe not quite as stuffy, but certainly they were there. The fact that he was ignorant of them, the fact that he never saw or talked to one of these people, except to glance at them from the side of his boat, doesn't mean that it didn't exist, you see. And by the way, there was a very interesting thing that happened in the British Royal Society, where a debate broke out between Darwin and his closest collaborator, Wallace, where Wallace got up and suddenly started making very strange statements, because they had a problem. The problem was, if the human brain is a manifestation of the level of evolution, why is the savage brain not vastly small? Why is it roughly the same or so large as the white British European brain? They had these gradations. Thomas Huxley was another one who believed it. He said the most highly evolved are the Europeans. The most highly evolved of the Europeans are the upper class. The most highly evolved of them are the upper class Englishmen. The most highly evolved of them are the members of our British Royal Society. Me. Why could the world be more like me, right? Huxley, with all the characteristic modesty of his class, decided it had that hierarchy. That was Darwin's hierarchy, too. But they had this problem. If these savages had such good brains, why weren't they more evolved? And Wallace got up and he says, you know, I don't think this is a problem, because I think they are evolved. And the thing about Wallace is he had lived in Melanesia for about 2 years. He says, I've lived with these people, and I find among them people who have a range of intelligence and subtlety and imagination and gift and craft and science within the confines of their material culture and all, which the best among them could compare favorably with members of our British Royal Society. And there was a gasp, of course. That was like saying, down with the Queen or something. And that was the difference between Wallace and, on one hand, and Huxley and Darwin on the other. With the emergence of capitalism, class power and privilege also were justified as manifestations of human nature. People are selfish. Some are go-getters, others are laggards. The system rewards and encourages the creative and the inventive and punishes the slothful and parasitic. But if it's so natural and it's so inevitable, why were the laws rewritten during the 19th century to protect and to arm the privileges of finance capital and industrial capital? I mean, if it was a natural thing that would just play itself out in the free market, why did you need the state? Why did you need to set up eminent domain laws, which were used to wipe out small property owners to the advantage of canal and railroad speculators? Or, as is done today, eminent domain still used to wipe out small property owners to make way for big developers and corporate investors who build their office buildings and shopping malls. Why were labor laws written to deprive workers of any means of self-protection? If it was all natural, everybody in their place, just as Plato said, the carpenter doing his carpentry, why did you need a law that made it a crime for the carpenter to talk to another carpenter and join together to try to better their lives? Why were gun thugs needed, and sheriffs and Pinkerton detectives and company goons and state militia and the U.S. Army used to keep people down? These people who were naturally in their place in this natural system that's part of the natural outgrowth, the ordinary diurnal activity of human nature every day. This civilization built on the gun and the sword and the rope and the whip, this is all perfectly natural, unforced, uncoerced. If it was so uncoerced, why is it a history of the most artificial coercive powers of the state, used repeatedly to give the wealthy every advantage and every predominance, as it's still being used to this day, right now, as we sit here and talk? If it's so natural, then why do they need death squads in El Salvador? If it's so natural to defend that imperialism and defend that natural system of capitalism, then why are people risking their lives against it in many parts of the world? Why use every subterfuge to keep the mass of people down, keep them divided, keep them disfranchised, if they're such laggards and if they're so uninterested in self-betterment? No, they're supposed to be interested in self-betterment. They're supposed to be interested in individual, selfish betterment. I want to better myself. I want to get ahead. Get ahead of what? Get ahead of the others. It's when they do collective self-betterment. It's when they begin to see that their self-interest is an interest of a whole social formation. That's when it becomes unnatural. And that's when we've got to go in there on that. Hmm. Now, in this age of democracy, where everyone is saying they're for democracy, we also hear this litany of capitalism and class ideology. You know, I happened to find myself in a hotel in Antigua once. It was an overnight. It was the most horrible experience I had. The travel agent said, it's okay, go there, it's informal. And I said, well, it's kind of expensive for a little informal hotel. I got there, and it was inhabited by rich American, British, and Canadian people. And I had dinner sitting at a table with these people, and it was rather fascinating. Because everybody sitting was white and rich. The women were talking about where they bought their gold. Said, we go to South Africa to buy our gold, saying things like that. It was really great. This was back in 1978, 9, around there. And the men were talking about investment opportunities and this place or that place and all that. And all of them were sitting, and they were white. And they got onto one of their favorite subjects, which white, rich, exploited people talk about, which is how lazy the poorer people are, you know. And I noticed everyone who was standing was black. The ones who were cooking the food, bringing the food, serving the food, and they were all black. Those were the lazy ones were black. And there were some people at those tables that never worked a day in their lives who were making statements. Well, you can imagine me choking on my food. But it's really interesting, the capacity for selective perception about what human beings are, the ability to have your class ideology serve and predefine your reality. I saw a documentary film once on Nicaragua, and there was an interview, a pre-revolutionary, before the Sandinista Revolution, an interview of a group of very well-to-do Nicaraguan men and women sitting on a veranda, dressed to the nines, with their drinks, and the men of their haunches and their dark glasses and all that, and the women were there with all the layers of jewelry and everything else, and the coiffured hair, and they're all sitting there. I mean, on their backs, they had enough to feed a whole Nicaraguan village for the better part of a year, I would wager. And they're sitting there, and they were doing that favorite sport when the rich get together, talking about what is so wrong with the poor. Why can't they just not be the way they are? They're just something. And then finally, one of them hadn't done any talking. This guy says, what the poor need is education. I said, hey, the liberal, here he comes. Thank God. There's one saying that. And I perk up a little, you know. The snarl begins to leave my face. And I get kind of my little hopeful Oliver Twist look on my face. And I look at him, and he says, the poor need education. I still remember his gesture. They need education in how to be human beings. And I go, the capacity for selective perception in regard to class, race, and gender realities is limitless. Reality is a secondary consideration or no consideration at all. Reality can be stood on its head. That seems to be a manifestation of human nature, or a certain kind anyway, of certain people in certain social situations.
Well, sisters and brothers, I've decided that there's white trash in this country, but don't look among the rural poor or Appalachia to find them. The real white trash is in the corporate boardrooms, the governor's mansion, the courthouses, the national media. If you work for or ally yourselves with the high place vipers and hypocrites and thieves and polluters and repressors and assassins, you are trash. I am sick of these so-called leaders who are leading us to the slaughter. I'm sick of their blow-dry hairdos, their sleek, beefy, money-fed smiles, their pinstripe suits, and their tight-ass struts down the corridors of power. I'm sick of the sight of them, and I hate them with all the passion of my humanity, and don't anybody tell me to feel otherwise.
The four, no, we're still not seated. We waited too long. it should be surging. But to know avail, off the rails hurting. Revolution will be loud, not televised. Systematic breakdown. Dark days left in longer, I break into a canter. Realize the reason, treason the answer. Deprecate play in the status game. Or cascade into the depth of the slain. Dark are the days.
Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days, dark are the days. Dark are the days.
Can't be shirking, jerking back and forth, working south to north and east to west, bless ocean and seas, marksman,
360 degrees,
dialectic, abstract, act and negate, I know you never found me, knock a heaven's gate, religion and illusion, opium of the people, and just saw busters, till we're equal, and so to the news, of a day dark, a child was abused, man stabbed in the park, the union's rejected, 9%, Lady Di's dress was heaven sent. We got mass confusion, therefore mass delusion. Media, a bourgeois institution.
Survive. No working 9 to 5 with no job pride. Wages impractical, the boss of Mr. Mister. Try like a slave for you ever since dismissed ya. Doctor, you clean up this slop ya. Suck up to the bourgeois and then they sack ya. Power struggles run amok and we bear the brunt. But marksman pump to stun bourgeois grunts. We past leading present, the future consequential. Reform fundamental, revolt potential. West implanted, East now supplanted. Sorry you're the selfish ones that ranted. But the marks bar lit the flame in the heart. And now the West ways are dark. Dark are the days.
Dark are the days. Dark are the days. Dark are the days. Dark are the days. Dark are the days. Dark are the days.
Dark side.
Dark are the days. 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 Dark are the days.
Dark side.
Days are dark. Watch me as a spark plugs, bust and disperse, thrust cuss is the hardness. Hard to the poet, the one that entertains. Even if I blow it, marksman remains. Cock the doo doo doo, son, all this has begun. Run a little lyrical, song cock shine. Little put a break on the man. He's got a system, but his system's out of hand. Overproduction of food is a crime. When there's mass starvation, a nation is dying. How can you justify stand up and decry the communist? When you stand for all this, persist in your madness and be damned. As the tables turn to a clenched hand.
From the dark side.